Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me? I check my bell bags every day in the sugar.
Hello, Steve.
Hello, Cheryl. So we are back, and Dear Sugar Radio is going to take on Guilt and Shame, my favorite law firm. And in fact,
how about we add regret? Guilt, shame, and regret. That sounds
exactly
more like a law
firm. They added him as a partner, you know? They immediately regretted it.
Regret's like the younger.
He's the younger. He's working his way up to Guilt and Shame. But I think about these sort of evil twins a lot, because especially in the case of shame, When something shameful has happened to me, when something I'm really usually trying to hide from public view, that's instantly a hot spot. I absolutely know that the path to truth is going to run through shame. It always, wherever other territory it passes through, it always passes through shame. And as a writer, that's just my impulse. If I know that there's something I'm really guarding and hiding, that's probably exactly where I need to head. But then, of course, I have to realize that as a civilian, that's not the way that I operate at all. And that most people, in fact, spend huge amounts of their emotional resources hiding the things that they feel ashamed of.
Right. And I think that sometimes that's why also we look to writing when we are in times of trouble or conflict, or we seek catharsis.
Yeah.
You know, didn't we all in high school, when we had that first heartbreak, you know, start writing really terrible poetry?
Oh God, we did. But what's so interesting is that when you look back at bad poetry, I've written a horrible little self-published book called Bad Poetry.
I know, I'm a fan of that book. It's an awesome book. Yeah.
But the larger point is that, you know, when you write a bad piece of writing, a bad poem or a bad essay or bad story, it's just a story that you weren't, there's a story hiding behind that story that you weren't ready to tell. And we've all written that high school poem about the dark river of my soul and the abyss of the, all these abstract words that sound like a Metallica song. And really what it means is my girlfriend broke up with me and it really hurt.
Yeah.
And it happened in a parking lot. And I remember that I was staring into.
See, mine was at the Galaxy roller skating rink.
I know, because I.
But maybe it was the parking lot of the roller skating rink. Not even
mentioned. But the interesting thing is that, you know, when I'm writing badly, it's essentially because I'm still covering up. I'm still trying to cover what the real story is, which usually involves guilt, shame, and their junior partner regret. And the truth is, when we are able to speak about the things that we're guilty or shameful about or regretful, we feel unburdened and also welcomed into the human family. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to talk about. Those are the kind of letters we're going to try to engage with today.
So let's get started.
Let's do it. Dear Sugar, when I was in college, I took a semester off to take care of a friend of mine who was about to get a bone marrow transplant to treat his leukemia. Things didn't look good for him, and I believed this was the biggest, most compassionate thing I could do. I could not save him, but I could show him how deeply he was loved. We spent several intense months together, and then he was judged to be healthy enough not to need a full-time caregiver, and I went back to my old life. I felt profoundly changed by the experience, but also at a loss, as he and I barely spoke after that, and never about the experience. During that time, we were intensely close. It was not romantic, but something even deeper. We were so wrapped up in each other that I decided to lose my virginity with him. It was also his first time. I felt safe with him, and I couldn't think of anything bigger I could give. This is important because I'm very definitely a lesbian. I'd been in several long-term relationships with women before this happened, and have been in several since. I have no intention of dating him. It's been almost 10 years since my friend's transplant, and he's doing much better. We've stayed in touch, and I still feel very close to him. When my last girlfriend and I broke up, he came to visit for a long weekend. We had sex again, and I really enjoyed it. A few months later, it happened again, and last night I bought condoms for the first time ever, because I'm hoping for more visits like those. I'm so confused, Sugar. I can't stop thinking about him. The problem is that my thoughts are not romantic. What I keep going back to is the time when he was sick. I've been constantly rereading my journals from that time and also the treatment log he posted online. I don't want to talk to him about it because I know he wants to forget that time in his life and move on. Why can't I move on too? I wasn't the one who had cancer. Now that I'm older, I also know what I did isn't even that big or spectacular. I was just so full of myself, thinking I was so important for taking care of him. For a long time, I thought I had done the greatest thing I would ever do, and so afterward, I felt adrift, wondering, what do I do now? While I certainly want your advice about that situation, I'm really writing because I'm about to do another big thing. I'm about to become a surrogate mother for a gay couple who are friends of mine. They've wanted a baby for a long time, and I know they'd be wonderful parents. I'm excited to do this for many reasons. But I worry that my compulsion to do radical acts of kindness will bring me back to the same point. 10 years from now, will I be obsessed with this child the same way I'm obsessed with my friend's cancer treatment? Or will I be able to let it rest on my list of things I'm proud of and not think about it all the time? Sincerely, obsessed.
Wow.
Wow is right.
What an interesting question.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, what a compassionate soul. You know, it's not just anyone who is willing to take a semester off of college to nurture and help and assist her friend, you know, a friend who's sick with leukemia.
Yeah.
You know, that's no small deed.
Right.
The part of her letter where she's talking about reflecting on that experience now as she goes back and reads her journals and, you know, she feels like she can't move on. She feels like she was doing the most important thing she'd ever done in her life.
Right.
What it brought to mind for me was, if you took those sentences and placed them into a letter, say, from a mother who had just sent her only child off to college, mm-hmm. it would fit in. Mm-hmm. It was very reminiscent to me of somebody who has made a big sacrifice for someone she cares about very deeply. And then now that sacrifice is no longer required, you know, because her identity is so wrapped up in making that sacrifice,
right.
What to do next.
Right.
To me, that's not so surprising since she did give up a piece of her life. What I'm most curious about and stumped by is this, you know, years later aspect of it, that she's, as she says, obsessed. She's right. Signed her letter obsessed. So the problem here is not the acts. It's how she feels about them
right.
and the place they have in her psyche.
Because on the one hand, this is this altruistic impulse, and it's absolutely brilliant and wonderful, especially in a world that's so self-involved and like the tradition of service that used to exist. It's like, of course. But it's also true that she was being rewarded in a certain way narcissistically by being this hugely generous person. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful that she cared for him. But hold on a second, you know, why is it that when you think about him, you don't just think this is a wonderful thing that I did, but it's the only thing that's important that I ever did?
Yeah. I think about this expression, to every virtue there is a vice. And, you know, her virtues are her generosity. The vice to that is that she doesn't seem to have a healthy relationship to her own decisions about generosity. So, you know, what do we see when we look at that? You know, when we look beneath that, you know, what motivates her? It sounds to me her trouble is it's like her identity is so wrapped up in that.
Right. I think actually the word I kept thinking of is stuck.
Yeah.
Because part of what the altruistic impulse can become is a way of sort of holding at bay what your needs are.
Mm-hmm.
That question you compare to a mother who sends her kids off to college. And then the question becomes, well, who are you?
Yeah.
Who are you in the absence of that role as the service, the person who's of service, the mother whose needs are subjugated to those of her offspring? And I would ask obsessed to consider, well, who are you beyond the person who was so heroically generous and wonderful to this sick friend of yours? What about your needs? What about what you want? Surely there are things that you want intrinsically that make you feel worthwhile and exalted and important and that give you meaning in life that don't have to rise to the occasion of helping a friend who's at death's doorway. And when we live in the past, everybody's got their version of the glory days, right? They look back and maybe you're a great athlete in high school, or maybe there was that golden period where you were living in New York and, you know, as Joan Didion says, none of the mistakes counted. You have that belief. It's the sort of exalted period of your life that you look back on over and over again. Hers is a period where she's doing these radical acts of kindness, but they clearly make her feel so important. And the other side of that is, oh, in the absence of that kind of radical act of kindness, your life isn't important. Mm-hmm. It's not important for you to, you know, pursue a healthy relationship, a healthy, loving relationship with your partner or with your family, or, you know, to go to work every day or whatever it is. It has to be the only way that you can really feel a sense of affirmation and that you're of worth, mm-hmm. is by something that radical and all absorbing. And I mean, I want to say, like, that's the Florence Nightingale story, mm-hmm. you know, is that there are people who are genuinely drawn to that kind of deep intensity of experience. That's my hunch, is that what she is really addicted to are these very radical, intense experiences where it is life and death, and she is performing heroically. And I think, I don't blame her at all. We all go in search of that.
We do. We go in search of it in so many ways. Like, when I'm writing, I'm obsessed. If I had a GoPro camera strapped to my forehead, it would seem like you were in the company of a madwoman. yeah. And it's glorious, and it's intense, and it's crazed, and it's heightened.
Right.
And so maybe, you know, the solution for this woman is, like, she actually needs to find a conduit for this energy. Right. I mean, maybe she is looking back on this time of her life because it was the most important thing she did.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's telling her something.
Well, to me, that's why I say, well, look, why not try being a hospice nurse?
Yeah.
If that's really what gives you a sense of affirmation, yeah. There's so many beautiful careers that she could pursue that would give her that feeling. Mm-hmm. There's a world of hurt waiting for her to show up and lend her compassion. But it's clear that there's something more complicated and stuck happening. And somehow the excitement of that moment has also gotten mixed up in her erotic life. She's a lesbian, but she has somehow started to confuse the feelings of wanting to be close to him and have that intensity of being the caregiver with the intensity of being the lover.
The lover, right.
And that part of it, I think she's quite right to say something isn't quite right here. And the idea that she is going to reiterate this pattern. I always say the best predictor, right, of what's coming is what's been.
Yeah.
And, you know, Faulkner, right? History is not even over yet. And that's, I think, what she is telling us. I fear that I'm about to undertake something that's going to have the same trajectory.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think, too, that one of the missing links for her, when we are coming to grips with past experiences, mm-hmm. I think her impulse to go back and read those journals isn't such a bad idea. It becomes problematic when it's this obsessive going over. And, you know, the thing is I know that this man, this friend that, you know, she saw through this difficult time doesn't want to go back and revisit that time. But she helped him in a big way.
Right.
And I would say that it wouldn't be too much to ask him to have one conversation with her about it. Maybe he can shed some light on this experience that they shared that would be useful to her when it came to putting that experience in its place, letting it go, or deciding to use it as a way to help her decide how to move forward with this without feeling obsessed about it or feeling troubled by it. It seems she's, you know, this past experience is troubling her when it comes to this surrogacy.
Right. She is recognizing that she's about to make a big, dangerous decision. Mm-hmm. That is not like helping a friend through an illness. It's bringing a life into the world that's going to still be there in 10 years. And an obsession or a fixation on that child is going to be unsettling to her, to the child, and to the parents. Mm-hmm. So before she does that, she needs to sort out why it is that these beautiful radical acts of kindness are also accompanied by these darker obsessional tendencies.
Mm-hmm. I am in full agreement. We wish you luck, obsessed.
Yeah.
You know,
the world needs more radically kind people.
They do. And, you know, it's really this letter, you know, on one hand, when we began talking about it, she presents a scenario that I don't, you know, directly relate to or identify with. Mm-hmm. And yet I think all of us have at some point struggled with generosity. And one of the things that was interesting to me reading recently, when you give a gift, you have a more positive response in the brain and the body than you do when you receive one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love giving, and I don't want to cast it as a narcissistic act. I don't think it's inherently that. But let us just say that it is true that we receive something positive when we give. A piece of this letter might be really for her to acknowledge the aspect of what is she getting from giving so much? And what does it cost her? And is it worth that cost?
Sugar thyself.
Sugar all thyself, right. Or thy shall be turned to
salt. pillar of salt. I believe that's in the Bible. Obsessed, we wish you all the luck we can, and please talk this over. Figure out why the beautiful giving part of you is also getting you a little wrapped up. I'm holding on
to anything. And will you do us another favor? Will you, a few months down the road, or however long it takes you to figure this out, write to us again? I'm really curious about, you know, how, what you come up with, what you find to be true as you grapple with this, because it is a really unique conundrum. I'm curious.
Me too.
We're like the Car Talk guys. It's like, call us back and tell us if, like, you know, was it the carburetor?
Was it? Yeah.
How did we both say the carburetor? That tells you how much we know about cars.
That's
the only
part we know.
Our next question deals with some pretty intense stuff, an experience regarding a rape that took place 15 years ago. I think that it's so interesting for us to discuss it at this moment in time, because there has been so much that we've been reading about not just sexual violence, but really women coming forward who were victims of this violence, you know, 5 and 10 and sometimes 20, 30 years ago. I think there's something happening in the culture right now, as burdened as I feel by just, you know, on a daily basis reading these, you know, terrible stories of sexual violence committed against women, I'm also encouraged by the fact that these women are coming forward. There's a reason they're coming forward. I think it's, you know, we're finally reaching a place where we're able to actually listen to these women and think about their stories with less judgment and more compassion than we as a society have managed to do in the past.
And all that being said, it's also true that it's some intense material, and so people should know that as we move forward.
Here's the letter. Dear Sugars, I'm writing to ask your much-needed insight into an almost 15-year question I've been carrying around. Was I raped? If I tell you the story I've told my friends, the answer will be a resounding yes. But you see, I've never told the whole story. So here it is. First, here's the version my friends know. On Halloween night in the late 90s, my friends and I went to a bar, and a former college classmate of ours was bartending. We all disliked this man, but were cordial, made some small talk, and he handed me a drink, a rum and coke. The next memory I have is waking up in a booth at the bar, barely able to lift my head off the table. The next memory is of my purple combat boots being dragged upside down through the parking lot. Next memory, I'm in a heap on the passenger side floorboard of a car. Next, I'm thrown onto my bed, on my stomach, and vomiting into a small trash can. Now here's where the extra details emerge. I was aware that the person who brought me home was this bartender. I was aware he was taking off my clothes. This drug I think I'd been given just made me not care about any of it. That's the only way I can explain it. I'm not going to lie, it felt good. This is the part no one knows. I may even have orgasmed. It was such a welcome feeling compared to the sickness I was feeling. He then had sex with me for hours. My body was responding. My mind didn't care. I did nothing but lie there. I was incapable of moving. Some I remember, most I don't. In the morning, I awoke to him sitting at the end of my bed smoking a joint. He said, "Are you on birth control?" And I said, "No. Why?" And he said, "Because we had unprotected sex 3 times. I then asked, "What made you think you could have sex with me?" He replied, "You said you wanted it." I said sarcastically, "Oh, I must have blurted that out between vomits." That was the end of the conversation, and he left. I called the police and asked if there was a way to get tested for being drugged. The dispatch guy was a jerk, and I was still feeling very sick, so I just hung up. Had he sounded even remotely compassionate, I would have pursued it. Next, I called Planned Parenthood and told them I needed to get the morning after pill. I'd had an accident with my boyfriend, I said. The condom broke. I lied. They made me sign a statement that I had not been sexually assaulted in any way. I signed. I lied. Nothing more came of it. I pretended it was no big deal. It was just sex. 1 year to the day, a note is slipped under my door. It says, "Happy Halloween." It was from the bartender. I was immediately consumed with a rage I wasn't aware I was carrying. Here's why I never further pursued this. 2 years earlier, I'd had a couple of sexual experiences with this guy. The first was when I'd just started college. This guy, the future bartender, takes me for a ride on his motorcycle. It starts to rain. We pull over and climb up into a little cave-like cliff to get out of the rain. As we're sitting there, he out of the blue pulls my shirt down, exposing one breast. If I'm going to be honest, sugar, it gave me a thrill. The next incident was shortly after that. He and I went backpacking to some hot springs. On this trip, he was pretty flirty and grabby. I kept putting him off. He kept insisting, regardless of this fact, that I was attracted to him and wanted to be with him. I kept saying no, and he kept trying to feel me up. Then he forcefully jams his hand down my pants. I let him stay there for a minute. That was it. We never had any more contact. I hadn't seen him for 2 years before the Halloween incident. You see, that is why I had never called the police again. It was due to this back history, of how it would look to my friends, of what a slut I was acting like, of the pleasure I felt during the Halloween incident. Was I raped, dear sugar? Or did my past actions have a direct impact on what happened? Signed, I live in the gray.
That is a... that is a long... Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an upsetting letter.
It's an upsetting letter, and... The first thing we have to say is that it appears this woman was drugged.
Right. For a number of reasons. Okay? I mean, we're obviously, as we discuss this, we're not, you know, a court of law. But, you know, she remembers things in a muddled way throughout the night. But she remembers quite a few things. Okay? She had one drink. And she's so inebriated from this one drink that she's got to be dragged.
Right.
Lying on the floorboard of a car. Being driven back to her house, dragged into her house, laying out on her bed, vomiting profusely for hours. And what is the first thing she does the next morning after this guy leaves? She calls the police.
Right.
She doesn't think, oh, crap,
that was
I drank too much and I slept
I
with that guy.
Right.
Which, you know, happens.
Right.
This doesn't sound like that to me. I want to say to this woman first, before we begin this long, complicated discussion, that... I don't think at core this is very complicated at all. I think there's no question that she was raped.
Right. I think what's so haunting about stories like this is that two things get equated that are not at all equal. She sent mixed signals. Okay.
Right. But we sometimes do that.
Right. But that's very different from what she's describing here, which is actually I was incapacitated. Did I somehow, her last line is essentially saying, did these previous episodes where I gave mixed signals, or maybe even signals that I was turned on, do those somehow erase the fact that while being drugged with no memory of having given consent, this man had sex with her for several hours? And the answer is no, actually.
Three times, unprotected.
Right. The tragedy here is she's got to recognize something bad was done to her. Don't do anything bad to yourself by saying, okay, but I contributed to it or I was complicit in it. You can be really turned on by somebody. Your body can respond to them. You can even become sexually engaged with somebody and they can still sexually assault you. And that's the distinction that gets so muddled. All these women, for instance, who are finally coming forward after years, there's a degree to which they internalize the shame of what happened and feel complicit in it. And especially in instances where they were turned on, that has to live alongside the fact that if there is no consent, that is rape. And a court of law might not recognize it, but it doesn't sound like that's what the woman is really after here. It's that she has to know, yeah, if you did not give consent, that's rape.
Yeah. I do want to say to this woman who signs, I live in the gray.
Yeah.
She lives in the light, and she lives among so many women whose stories are almost precisely like her own. I know we have people out there listening who've had this experience. All of those people are nodding their heads right now as they're listening, because this is a very familiar story.
Right.
It seems odd and unique and terrible and complicated and twisted, and but listen to this, and then this happened and the other thing. But actually, it's a very, very ordinary story that follows a very predictable trajectory. A young woman who has, you know, these interactions with this man, some of them sexual. Some of them she herself desired, some she didn't. You know, is then raped by this man and then made to feel in part responsible for her rape to the extent that she's not even clear that she was raped. And so this is these all of these things aren't signs that, you know, oh, maybe there's more to the story. These are all signs that, you know, for whatever reason, for reasons that we can point to, you know, in brief or at length, but concisely say, because these are the values of a rape culture. You know, these myths and ideas that we've all grown up with about what constitutes rape always serve to silence the victim.
Right.
And to grant power to the perpetrators. And what's happening right now is, you know, we're going through a huge cultural shift. I frankly think that's why we got this letter right now. You know, 15 years have passed, and this woman is finally strong enough to just tell us the truth.
Right.
The whole truth, including she might have had an orgasm in the course of her rape.
I think that's right, that part of what would be, you know, healing for her is to share the full details of the story. Like, why hold it back? It's because she thinks it's something shameful, but it's not shameful. It's tragic.
Mm-hmm.
I think she feels that she can't even tell the full story to her friends. It will somehow undo the rape that she experienced. It will actually make her the Jezebel or the temptress.
Right.
And she is internalizing that sense of, well, if I tell them, I'll be a slut. Your friends aren't going to sit there and say you're a slut. These are your friends.
Mm-hmm.
You owe it to yourself to seek their support and to not carry around the deceit of like, well, I only told them a little bit of the story.
Mm-hmm.
She's coming clean with us about the full story.
Right.
It's like, I think that's a beautiful first step, but it's like, hey, you're not alone in this.
No.
This is the oldest story in the book, or one of them.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, one of the most powerful things we can do to change our culture when it comes to questions of sexual assault and rape and coercion and consent and all of those things is really to start to be brave enough to tell the true stories.
Yes.
You know, so that we don't just have that one narrative of the sexually pure woman who's, you know, raped by the guy lurking in the bushes, when we know that in fact the stories are more complicated than that. You know, you're far more likely to be raped by somebody you know,
yep.
Somebody perhaps that you have been sexually intimate with. You know, the more stories we hear about what sexual assault looks like just gives us all a lot more freedom, I guess. And, you know, this I feel really personally and acutely, and I think this is why perhaps, you know, this letter in particular makes me feel so emotional.
Yep.
You know, I grew up with my father, my biological father, was very physically abusive to my mother, emotionally abusive, and also as one of the last acts of their marriage, one of the last things I remember of them being together is my mother was leaving my father.
Hmm.
And anyone who works in domestic violence will tell you that this is a really dangerous time in a family's life.
Yep.
It's the time that, you know, the perpetrator is most likely to commit homicide and, you know, all of these things. And certainly the violence in my family had escalated during this time that my mom was finally once and for all putting her foot down and saying she was going to leave. And one day my father was in a rage at my mother and he, right in front of us, attacked my mother and raped her. Mm. And my mother was, you know, yelling and telling me and my sister and my baby brother, who we were looking after, you know, to leave. She knew what was happening. She knew what we were seeing. And she was yelling at us, get out of here, get out of here. And I had never seen this before. I didn't even know what was happening. It took me really a few years to understand what I had seen.
Yeah.
And what I'd seen is my father raped my mother. I did obey my mom. I left. I didn't see all of it, but I saw enough that it was an image that imprinted itself in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I reflect on that now as a grown up, and I really think, wow, you know, what if my mom had gone to the police that day? She might have been able to press charges against my father for hitting her, but I don't believe that at that time in the state of Minnesota, it was illegal for a husband to forcibly have sex with his wife.
Right.
And so, you know, what happened, how those laws changed is that women told their stories.
That's right. The word complicity in the context of this letter is sort of, well, I was turned on by him, or I sent mixed signals. Here's what real complicity is. Silence.
Yeah.
In this context is complicity. And you're speaking about your own experiences and this woman, even in the tentative way that she has, that's the only way it goes away. This has to do with any kind of moral progress that the culture makes, is because people have refused to remain silent and have demanded a greater share of humanity.
That's right. And I would just really encourage this letter writer to tap into the power of that.
Yeah.
To not keeping this, you know, messed up, terrible, ugly experience in her little hidey hole of shame or
yep.
or secrecy or wherever she keeps it. And, you know, just brought it into the light. I mean, in some ways, she's already done it with this letter. And yeah. I'm so grateful for that.
I am, too. And I hope that she does talk with her friends.
I do, too.
Yeah. Live in the gray. We all live in the gray. Don't live in silence about these things.
That's right. And I wish you the best in your life.
In the worst way, in the worst way, in the worst way.
Dear Sugar Radio is produced by WBUR in Boston. It is produced and edited by Lisa Tobin.
Engineering and production help by Jim Brumberg. And you can write to us at DearSugarRadio@gmail.com.
And also remember to listen and subscribe on iTunes. We are grateful for all your support, all your letters, all your ears.